Good evening and welcome to the Gloucester Writers Center. I'm very thankful and happy to have you all here for our reading tonight of the work of the Women's Writing Group, In Our Own Words, and with a special guest, Joe Cardoza of the writing group Mining the Hat, which meets after In Our Own Words and sometimes crosses over. So we're very friendly. We keep the sanctity of the women's group and then carry it over sometimes. And so Joe is very familiar with all of us, and we're familiar with Joe, and we invited him to join us here tonight also. The group, In Our Own Words, started several years ago as a way to help women of limited resources find a way to have a voice, share that voice, and be comfortable in a safe place, knowing that their voice would be respected and heard. And as time has passed, the composition of the group has shown us that we all have limited resources, one way or another. And we found that our loose definition has let us create a group that crosses. It doesn't show tonight because we have a few members who aren't here, but we've crossed ethnic lines, class lines, educational divisions, and we've really created a group that everybody brings something different to the group. And of what they bring, everybody is respected. And it's been a wonderful place to work and to bring out, to not only help people find the best way to get their point across, but to learn from what they bring to the group. So I'm very honored to have this group to work with. Tonight we have a few members who have work that will be represented by other people will be reading it. We have two of our founding members have medical problems and weren't able to come tonight, but we're happy to have their stories to share with you. So we will announce those as they're read. And thank you for coming tonight. Without further ado, our first reader is Hillary Crowley. And, yep. Okay. Remember when I said, is this all right with you?
No, I didn't look at that. But this is great. I'm great.
And then if I could ask each reader as they come up, to announce yourself, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Hillary. I'm from Exeter, New Hampshire. I think I heard the word Worcester in the crowd. I'm from Worcester originally, but I live in Exeter now. Great, this microphone. Hi. Hi, everyone. I did not see that I was first. And that's a blessing. I'm going to start. One of the things that we do in the writing group is sometimes we're just given an assignment and then we're given 15 or 20 minutes to just write right there. And it's a good time to get our thoughts out. And about four Wednesdays ago, we were all, I think it's safe to say, commiserating about the weather. And there was just a lot going on. So the assignment was, the question was, what lies beneath this snow? This is humorous, okay? Does dog poop turn to mud in the spring and fertilize the lawn? No, I've found it's preserved frozen by winter, then thawed like butternut squash, only to mush and even smell of its original fresh form. And the boots will come inside with dark brown mix of fecal matter and wet dirt. When I step outside, will I step in this? Yes, I will. I will have to rush in when I have to find my last pair of clean pants when everything else is wet in the machine. This time it might be light brown and smear between my fingers as I push the ground to awkwardly stand up. I should be one of those homeowners who cleans up after her dog. But it's my yard, and more snow is coming, and it will disappear again under this white frosting of denial. It will be covered with the water bill, the broken manuscript, funeral tears, father anger, mother grief, a lousy wardrobe, the unhealed scabs on my cat's face, the December decorations, the dead orchid, the flower pot next to the depleted wood pile. It's all shit. It's all morning poop from a happy young pup simply satisfied to get outside, defecate, turn, and bark at me. the next is, I just have to set these up. I don't even know what act I have to follow. So, the next was written this summer was I'm in an adventure. On July 17th, I took custody of a state child for permanent placement. So I adopted a 9-year-old. And so it was probably Amanda suggested you should write a lot during this time. So I did. And here's our record of about 2 weeks, we had the brilliant idea of let's go on vacation. Okay. And it's important to know, because it is just an entry, that the name of my new son is William. And the son that I already had is Wyeth, like the name Wyeth. Okay, here we go. It's overcast in Casco, Maine this morning. We drove 34 minutes to our class again. It's become a vacation routine. It's important for William to be a strong swimmer. Today, Wyeth came along with us. For me, it's a small victory to have them together for an activity. I'll take any win I can put on the scoreboard. It's been a rough start to our growing family. William has been with us since July 17th. Today is August 12th. On Friday, he turns 10 years old. Wyeth turns 10 in January. Friday could be a difficult day. The tensions are already thick, even without the loaded celebration. This morning, William asked me if he's still going to get to see his dad every Friday. Or is that coming to an end? Honestly, I don't know the answer to this question because the state is still in charge of that relationship. What I do know is that in late July, I scheduled my day around a social worker picking up William and bringing him to the bowling lanes 5 blocks away to play with his bio dad. I thought I would feel trepidation or even concern when he left, but that day I was looking forward to the 90-minute break and wanted to see how he responded after returning from such a visit. I was relaxing on the back deck about 30 minutes after he left when I heard the car pull into the driveway. I walked around the house and was surprised to see William and the social worker were back. She announced in a contrived voice that, "We think maybe Dad's car broke down." William seemed concerned but not heartbroken, and I was relieved and remembered that his bio dad is notoriously unreliable. So this morning I was irritated to hear about how he hasn't seen his dad in a while and how his dad's a really good dad and he's caring and loving and Then I tell him to get... Then I'm thinking that I want to tell him to get his sorry ass up here and pick him up from his vacation and take care of him yourself. I'm not upset with you, William, but as far as his social workers and teachers and doctors, something needs to be said about his father's failure. I compare it to telling a child that his father is alive in the hospital room when he died 4 months ago. It's a harsh example, but not altogether inaccurate from this boy's perspective. I don't feel loving when I'm angry, but I think it's a deeper sort of love. It's the kind of love that's in it for the long haul, and it isn't looking for fairy dust and roses. I want to know where this little boy's heart is after the scar tissue heals from his old wounds. Yesterday, we were also at swim class at 10 a.m. On the ride home, I picked up some cream for the coffee drinkers back at the lake house. About a quarter mile after pulling away from the store, I saw a small dark object in the road. A leaf or a rock or a turtle. It was a turtle. It was moving. It was a turtle. Wait! I jumped out of the car and ran 30 feet back and waved to the upcoming Honda SUV to stop while I reached out to scoop up the turtle with both hands. As soon as I touched its shell, the four legs and hands retreated into a nice compact package to lift and carry safely to the other side. I placed it in the grass. I waved back to the Honda, whose driver was smiled and let me cross as I sprinted back to the car. In the back alone, William had opened the door already and he was ready to flee. He asked, "What just happened?" "It was a turtle. I stopped for turtles in the road." "Oh, I didn't know what was happening. I thought you just left." Mm-hmm. He was right. I didn't inform him that as I sprang out of the car and ran up to the center of the road, he probably couldn't even see that I was carrying a turtle. "Oh, yeah," I said, keeping it lighthearted. "You probably need to know that I jump out of cars sometimes to save crossing turtles. But they'd be okay even if they were hit by a car because they have hard shells." "No, buddy," dealing with the harsh reality. No, those shells would crush into sharp shards and the turtle would be squished. Oh, William watched the treetops as we drove on. Good thing you stopped. And then I have a bonus. I didn't get it approved with you. It was... I feel like I need to get everything approved with you in the best of ways. So much respect for Amanda. Oh, my goodness. I didn't have to come down last weekend, but I came down because I love the writings group so much. Turned out there was a sickness and I didn't check the email, but it worked out perfectly because I was able to spend the day at the Cape Ann Museum instead. And I was really moved by the exhibit, the one-man show on the top floor, an artist that I wasn't familiar with being from Exeter, New Hampshire, and not being well-versed in the artistic world. I was there for a writing group, and his name is...
Roger Martin,
exactly. It was Wednesday. I was alone, and I was moved to the fact that I had to sit down on the bench and I just wept. And I don't know why I was weeping. I don't know if it was about just to be in the space of a man's work, whatever. I was moved. And then I found out that I may have been moved by his spirit itself that had recently passed. So, but what struck me the most is if anyone's seen the exhibit, there's a poem on the wall where he references Wendell Berry and how he doesn't have a patch of farmland. Up in Exeter, I took a poetry class, and I referenced Robert Frost. And my the feedback I got was, you shouldn't reference Robert Frost in a poem because it's totally pretentious, and I totally agreed. Oh. And I buried it, but I feel like Roger would have liked this one. It's called Waking Too Early. 6 miles south of the porch where Robert Frost crafted poetry, at 7:19 on a brook that carved those miles, more proficiently than any heaved pavement we might travel today, I found an inviting rock at my campsite to face the waters and sip my tea, because that's a cliche I couldn't avoid after waking too early. Already these shared words have pulled my gaze from changing light blazing, the mossy bark from a reserved rare minutes. I need to record the small tree I see across the watery path. Small, but not young. No wonder it does not strive like its neighbors 4 feet inland. Safe for now, but that big maple deceivingly secure in the rocks and the dirt. My lone eyes can imagine those hidden roots are not immune to the next ice over. So I look to learn from the little one that scores its roots straight out into the air. The other half anchored to the muddy banks, while the naked entanglements do not apologize for leaning in and keeping vital against the common law of life. Only reminding me of every person who ever cherishes a past of something gone, who will wait until the next retelling of the cherished regret. Every person is made vulnerable and raw when the soil of the seeded start erodes. We stretch our roots to the air, knowing the nourishment is beneath. We expect to receive because our roots grew in the direction long ago. With this little tree, I see patience and hope, knowing that the waters rise and snow envelops, and these medium summer mornings are not for measuring. These roots will be reburied. Frost sits here next to me, not to frolic or profess. He asks me to witness the metaphor that is the only true teacher. He likes how the rock makes a loud gurgle sound. He likes how the rocks make a loud gurgle to leave me hypnotized away from my campsite tasks. He likes the roots too, and says there are few words to match this lesson, yet they are worth grappling for. He tells me he loved everything here and reminds me not to miss my turn. Everybody has a turn.
Testing. Okay, I'm Trish Wilson, and I've actually been published. I publish with the name Elizabeth Black when I'm writing romances, and E.A. Black when I'm writing the creepy, scary stuff, because I write dark fiction and horror. And I'm going to read a portion of a novel that I wrote called Secrets and Lies. And it's just been accepted by a publisher, but the contract sucks. So I have to rewrite it and negotiate it and get back with them. So it's still up in the air as to whether or not it's going to get published. But at least one place wants it. So I'm going to work hard to make sure that everything turns out okay. And the book is about a young woman living in New England, in this general area. And her brother finds her father dead in their home. So she's looking into her father's death and then starts upturning all of the skeletons in the family closet. And everybody is trying to basically tell her to shut up, stop looking, go back to your life and leave us all alone, because they have a lot of secrets that they don't want to have get out. So I'm going to start. This is part of the first chapter. The air inside the house reeked. It had that musty, wet dog stench common to untended old homes that no amount of bleach could eradicate. Robbie wondered how the house could smell like that. His father never owned a dog. There was no sign of Franklin, the cat, which didn't surprise him, because that animal answered to no one. It was probably stretched along the second floor wall near the fireplace, which was always warm regardless of whether or not a fire burned in the hearth. He had always admired that cat. It was the only living creature that had the nerve to live its life as it pleased in his father's presence, if only Robbie had that kind of gumption. Under the wet dog bouquet, Robbie smelled boiled fish and something fetid he couldn't identify. He curled his nose to ward off the stink. God, when was the last time his dad cleaned the litter box? Does Dad even have a litter box? He nearly tripped over a fireplace poker that lay in the hallway as he marched toward the foyer, toward the living room. What the hell was it doing all the way out there? Who knew what his father did with all his time alone? He always misplaced things. Wouldn't be surprised if he had Alzheimer's. Dad, come on, knock it off. We're going to be late, Robbie shouted. What are you doing? I really can't play this game with you every time I come over. What a miserable excuse for a human being. Maybe it was all the stress of living with him that aggravated the cancer that killed his mother 5 years ago. Dad, we really have to get out of here, or I'll have to reschedule your appointment for the fourth time. You know, if you were living in a rest home rather than this draft tunnel, it looked like someone had taken a wrecking ball to the living room. The dining room chairs had been thrown on their sides. Shattered crockery and glassware lay in piles at the base of two antique crystal cabinets. A brass floor lamp lay across the rug, its round, fringed shades crushed like a spent balloon. The family painting, a banquet-sized oil that normally hid the safe above the fireplace mantel, had been tossed to the floor and shredded. These were not random slashes. The majority was across Matthew's face, the fewest scored that of Clara, Robbie's mother. Deep tears gaped in the canvas where Robbie's sister Kate's face had once been. The slashes that coursed across his face in the portrait disturbed him so much that he ran his palms over his cheeks. The safe was open and empty. Robbie knew that his father kept some stock certificates, rubber-banded wads of cash, paperwork related to the family business, and old letters in there. He couldn't remember what else was in there, but whatever it was now gone. When he first saw the blood on the floor next to the brake front, he wasn't sure what it was. It took a few seconds for the scene to sink in. He took a few steps closer to the tableau to get the full view. The smell hit him square in the face. It was so strong that he could taste it, thick and metallic. His stomach convulsed. He swallowed to keep from vomiting. His father lay face up with his arms and legs splayed at cockeyed angles, like a marionette that landed in a broken pile when tossed in its box after the show was over. A gaping hole that remained of his father's face. Robbie averted his gaze so that he wouldn't have to look where those accusing eyes had been. He squeezed his own eyes shut so tightly that he could see the blood flowing in dark waves that mimicked the spray of splattered gore on the wall behind his father's head. When he composed himself, he opened his eyes. Bugs Bunny heckled him from the television, one finger pointing at him as if all this was his fault. He looked at the framed photograph that lay at his father's feet. Letters and numbers were scrawled on the glass in what appeared to be blood. EX25347, LA57, 2SA1210, 1KI141011. That was the same code written in red magic marker on a flyer that sat in his desk at home. He'd received it in the mail 1 week ago. No return address, unsigned. No clue as to what it meant or why he had received it. Now he had an idea what it was about, and he didn't like it. He ran for the phone. He punched in four numbers and then hung up. No, not yet. Not him. He had a better idea. His hands trembled so badly that he could barely dial the number. He couldn't figure out if his hands trembled out of fear or from guilt at wishing his father dead for so many years. Maybe it was a little of both. He heard a dial tone at the other end. Pick up, damn it. Pick up the goddamn phone. Please pick it up. Hello? Ian, it's Robbie. You better get over here. What's wrong? I'm at Dad's. He's dead. I don't know what happened. The house is a wreck. It looks like a robbery. His face. Oh, dear God. He's been bludgeoned. Robbie, try to stay calm. Get out of the house. Go sit on one of the benches out front. I'll get some help. Robbie knew better than to touch anything. If anyone knew how to handle something like this, it was his brother-in-law, Ian Stanwood. Ian would involve the mainland police, which was exactly what Robbie wanted. That was why he called Ian first rather than his uncle, Peter Weston. Peter, Matthew's younger brother, was the family patriarch and peacemaker. He stuffed the skeletons firmly into their respective closets and swept the family dirt under the rug, which in this case would be far more literal than Robbie was willing to admit. The Westons had always been very private people who did not appreciate outsiders, especially mainland police, getting involved in their affairs. The risk of embarrassment or scandalous familial secrets getting out was too great. Peter would be livid over Cape Ann's presence, but Robbie didn't care. Maybe this time someone over there would listen. He couldn't allow Peter to brush off Matthew's death the way he had hidden all the other family problems. Robbie thought he had his life under control. He had everyone's sympathy. His father was not an easy man to deal with. There were 9 doctors in Caleb's woe. 8 of them had already dealt directly with Matthew's delightful temper. All had refused to see him again. The only reason the doctor agreed to see him was that Robbie, who owned a real estate company, had given the man a kickback on a summer rental in Martha's Vineyard. Favoritism of this sort was illegal in the real estate business, but Robbie didn't care about that. When he benefited in some way, Robbie didn't think twice about bending the laws in his favor. Anyone could be bought if the price was right. That was Robbie's philosophy of life. Robbie's primary motivation in caring for his father was to seize that house once his father was out and properly stashed away in a nursing home. Both he and his father knew it. Matthew had told Robbie with great glee that he would not get his mitts on it until after he was dead and rotting. What infuriated him most of all was watching how his father especially enjoyed making sure Robbie knew that he had no intention of budging for as long as humanly possible. The man lived to make his son miserable. After death, he continued to make his son miserable, and Robbie had a bad feeling that Matthew's death was the latest in a series of events that weren't going to end anytime soon. The object of Matthew's feet was a 12-by-24 framed full-color cover photo of the July 1957 issue of American Artist, which normally hung in the library down the hall to the right near the front door. On June 11th of that year, the family business, the Weston Gallery of Fine Art, achieved its peak with its nationally renowned exhibit of the best of abstract expressionism. That exhibit had elevated the Weston Gallery from a run-of-the-mill regional art gallery to one of the premier cultural centers in New England for the next 5 years. American Artists covered the exhibit at that issue. The photograph on the cover page depicted 5 people standing on the granite steps of the gallery. Robbie's parents, Matthew and Clara Weston, his aunt and uncle, Mary and Peter Weston, and the genius who put the gallery on the map, public relations liaison Vivian Haythorne. Robbie didn't see any of that this morning. He was too busy taking in the letters and numbers splattered on the glass. He had not thought of the scandal that encompassed his family and the gallery in years. Obviously, whomever had upturned his childhood home had, and that person wanted to make sure that the surviving Westons did not forget. He thought about that opening and about what had happened to him over the past couple of weeks. Someone had been stalking him. Hang up calls in the middle of the night. His laboratory retriever was dognapped. He didn't even know if the animal was still alive. Weird mail with the same strange code on it. A feeling that he was being watched. The punctured tire that almost sent him into a tailspin during a rainstorm last weekend. Sandy's husband, Dean, following him around the Stop and Shop like a junkyard dog, ready to tear him open on top of the free-range lamb special. The sheets he used at a beachfront rental had been cut to ribbons. He used those sheets so that he wouldn't stain the unsuspecting owner's mattress when he humped on it with his other mistresses, the ones that he was sure neither Sandy nor his wife Carol knew about. He thought that Dean was behind the problems. Looking at his father's mangled face, he wasn't so sure of that anymore. His bright idea of involving the mainland police suddenly didn't seem so bright. There were certain personal secrets he didn't want to see get out, like the cookbooks at the real estate office and the income he hadn't declared on his tax returns. Damn, he wished he had called Peter. Neither the mainland police nor Ian needed to know about Robbie's mail. He had told Peter about it immediately after receiving it. At first, he had thought that Dean had sent the message, but now, looking at his father, he was sure that wasn't the case. Peter would call in his own private investigators. They were the only ones who needed to know Robbie's secrets. On the other hand, he was sure Peter's self-selected posse would be no match for the person who had gone at his father's head. Robbie picked up the picture, walked to his car, and placed it in the trunk. Out of sight, out of mind. No one needed to know about it. Wow. And that's more than enough.
Thank you. I'm going to be reading a story by Jody Stewart, who has been with the group since it started longer than I have. She started writing with Charlie Bianchini there many years ago, and this is a story that's very important to her. I wish she was here to read it tonight. The answer. I could hear the rats scrape as they rushed close in the dark. "Get out of here," I said, a small, trembling sound that trailed off. Nearing the outer curve of my eye, I swore I saw something move. Straining, both hands tight over my mouth, I held a scream. My eyes forced shut. Mumbling, I begged of no one except maybe the rats. Crouching, crowded in, I continued to clear a spot in the piled corner to corner of clothes. A smell like damp dirt and rotting leaves hung from the moldering cloth. Pressed against my back in front of the washing machine, it felt cold and I slid down to sit safely. I searched the dark. Pulling my knees up, I wrapped them tight with my pajamas. A ladder rip on the back where a button had been, nearly worn through, the white nightgown only covered as far as my knees. No matter how hard I tugged, my hand shaking slightly, I traced the letters in Angel, stitched in gold thread across the faded ruffled top. I remembered when it was delivered from the Sears catalog, how it had also doubled as a Halloween costume. I remembered the felt wings tied on my back with satin ribbon. I had grown since. There were many murky forms, so many shadows. I heard the clinking, whirring hum of the furnace. I strained to see in the distance, into the pitch black. A dreaded place of punishment, the basement was so big and cluttered. Vague shapes, spider webs in the rafters, shelves of wood-dusted tools, children's toys, and hoarded needless things. The ceiling creaked, footsteps above me in the kitchen. Then the voice that was furious with me. The voice I knew not to question, just to keep out of the way. My cheeks heated with shame. She didn't want to look at me, the dark-haired one. I stayed still, except the steady shiver of almost bare skin, quiet except the chatter of my teeth and a whisper of hope. The wind howled, moaning past the sides of the house, scraping across the cellar windows in a terrorizing rattle. I busied myself, pushing the piles away, moving my hand around in the dark, careful of what could be crawling there. I willed myself strong. Not a single tear would come, not one. They were all there just the same. I picked and pulled until I uncovered some papers, the lid to a baby food jar, a tiny nub of a pencil, and what I decided was an apple knife. I imagined tasting the crisp, sweet fruit. My hand grasped something else. I brought it close to my face until I recognized it as a book of matches. Trembling, I squeezed my toes between my hands. They pulsed with the cold. Only then I began to cry. The groan of an intensifying storm kept my concern. The window glass rattled, shaking my heart. My chest ached, a dull, constant hurt. I stayed in the seated position, turning left and right, grabbing at me for more paper. Finally, I scraped the side of my hand across the cleared place on the cement floor. Adding torn scraps to a crushed page of newspaper, the knife kept close, guarding me against sneaky gatherers. I lit the first match. The tiny flame was a streak of light flashing through the dense, musty gloom. I could see the ripped paper pile was the first place poem I had written about the American flag. I muttered something hateful. Then the second, by the third and final match, the pile had burnt out. Somewhere in my chest, in between the aching, a swell of turning anger claimed me. I made a decision in that moment, a decision that seemed crazy, but a moment of clarity just the same. I would not stay. Nothing I did was ever good enough. I wasn't wanted. Locked in the basement, left there to rot like tossed clothing and probably the rats, my anger stunned me. I understood it as a relief to all the wanting. I used the pencil to etch five letters in that cleared place on the floor. It was too dark to see what I knew. I had left my name there. Slowly, my hands outstretched, I felt my way across the room. I paused only when I hit a toolbox with my toe and then again when I reached a thin horizontal line of dull light. I stepped up the four wide planks. Ignoring the sting of cold metal against my palms, it took all my anger to force. The sound of the hinges that needed to be oiled exploded into the silence. Wind traveled up the line of my spine. A frightened sadness had me breathe once again. My heart, a sharp-edged rock, restricted a gulp of cold air. My nostrils burned. I expected to see the measly patches of grass in the yard. The moment I fully opened the bulkhead, when the soles of my feet pressed into the snow and the wind lashed at my face, I began to cry again. Every piece of me shook. I am not sure which was stronger, my fear or the icy stun. For me at that time, the life I would leave behind was not much more than the cold, dark confinement of that locked basement, the discarded poem of a little girl written on what was once a clean white paper. In a welcoming sense, I thought I might die. It just didn't matter. Beneath breath steaming ahead of me, I set out. Where I was headed, I did not know. I told myself anywhere would be better. Arms crossed tight against my chest, burying my skin even more. I asked heaven for help, even though I questioned if I was heard. Worthless me. Crossing the yard, I looked back at the dim glow of the light inside the house. Nothing made sense. It was bitter cold where I stood, but inside that house was a different kind of cold, the kind that never left. That made you shiver, no matter if it were an August day at high noon, the cold of an always present fear. Stopping on the sidewalk, I didn't stand there long. Inside my heart, I said my goodbyes. The street was deserted, layered white. I looked around at the home lights of the other families along the way. Beyond the basement door, a little more than halfway to the street corner, was a fire hydrant. I had counted exactly how many steps on many occasions. My visibility narrowed in the windswept white veil. I couldn't see it between the piled snow. I needed to know where it was there, in the usual place. I hugged myself tighter. Panic vibrated just below the surface, out of time with shivering in the strike of my heart. I kept going, past the houses, past an elderly neighbor's across the street. The way she smiled at me, her satin red mouth and the maze of her wizened face. "You're just a weed of a girl, aren't you?" she said. Once she gave me a cookie. For a moment, I wondered if I would ever see her again. The houses towered, overshadowing the street. It had never seemed so tall before. The steps never so long. I didn't know if I could ever be free. That house and everyone inside were in so many ways intertwined. Could I ever be separated? Past the hydrant, around the far side in line with the sidewalk, I kept pace, staying close to the careless layers of a snow-covered wall. The twists and turns of stone divided and connected to the house and to the street. I started out walking, then began to race past, as steady as I was able. It took all of me up against the wind, slowing only when the truck, the gold station wagon in the driveway, and the lights inside the house were behind me. Ahead of me was a steep rise. I thought of my brother's bicycle with no brakes, the crash that got me stitches. I waited to hear a sound, only the numbing wind and the click, click, clicking of my teeth. When I neared the top of the hill, my legs felt as if they were solid metal blocks. Each step was a small triumph, strengthened with anger. Sliding, I fell to my knees. No longer could I feel the raw burn within my toes. The sting through my feet was weakening quick, even though I was shivering uncontrollably. A streetlight bordering the highest point of the hill flickered in an eerie amber light. It was as if I was being warned. I wouldn't. I couldn't turn around. Not now. It surprised me that my mouth was dry. The flakes I caught on my tongue didn't help. My hair, dripping wet, set on my face. It was as if every inhale sucked the bitter cold towards me, freezing up the dark, soaked snarls atop my head. I could feel the threads in each of the golden letters. Angel, rubbing against my skin with each shift of the stiffened nightgown. I wished I had real wings. Then maybe I could just fly away. I got a glimpse of swaying bare treetops. Then, as the wind changed direction, I saw the bronze-faced moon looking down. It hung so high above me. Anger stopped pushing me, and I was lonely in that second. Suddenly, I couldn't help but be scared. I didn't know if I could save myself. Doubt rising, steady, I thought about the house down the hill behind me. I was too tired to look back again. I turned the corner a few steps, crossing the street, noticing scatters of blood, scattered blood drops glistening in the white. I finally reached the leveled crest. I could either go further up or downhill. I had planned to go straight up, but understood that I probably wouldn't make it. I thought the steady wind would peel my skin away and my bones would shatter. My elbows and shoulders hung. Clumsily dragging my feet through the deepening snow, I steadied a soaked shiver. I moved on. It seemed to take hours to reach the bottom. When I did, I braced myself. Both hands throbbed as I pressed along a low granite wall surrounding the yard of a cornered house. I stopped there, half-leaning, half-collapsing into the outer turn of the stones. My head heavy. I did not feel my hands or feet. I no longer shivered. Red blood trailed, adding a stain to the snow. The wind cried like many from the other side in a struggle to be heard. I realized that if I had stayed in that house, I was lost, but in leaving, I was also lost. My lips moved uneasily, like they were only partially joined. I spoke out loud, though barely a whisper, and I asked a question. I asked of the night, the snow, the wind, that hopeless moment. Does heaven even know that I am here? Does God even know my name? My words echoed back to me, borne by the wind. I breathed a short, tired breath. I no longer felt as though I stood on the ground. In a single beat, everything, my body, my thoughts, the snow, my eyes, all moved slow in a peaceful, easy motion. The wind up and left me alone. It took an effort to blink away the snowflakes gathering in my lashes. I caught a smudge that grew longer. Out of the gleaming snow, left from the corner in the direction of a church, a shadow stepped out from the white. I don't know where he came from. He was just there. In that instant, I noticed the streetlight, somewhat more than a car length off, ahead above me. Funneled honey yellow light backlit thousands of silent gliding snowflakes. As if in a dream, filaments of slanted light, graceful, miraculous, like tiny pieces of chipped glass. In a gradual calm, I could almost hear each snowflake fall. I didn't move. I couldn't hide. I wasn't afraid. His face held an easy smile as he shook snow from his sleeves. He said nothing. Moving forward, closer, he faced me. Without hesitating, he picked me up, cradling me inside his coat, so tight that I could feel his chest breathe. I thought I may just fade into that feeling of warm, almost liquid, running in a deep ripples from the outside in, a warmth that pushed against physical sadness until it fell away, and what I held dark inside had thinned to almost nothing. My head rested well into his shoulder, weightless. I turned, looking up beyond his strong chin, staring at his shiny face. He looked to me like the answer. I was awestruck he was so beautiful. He brushed my cheek, pushing the icy strands away from my face. His hand had me think of the velvety tulip petals in my cousin's yard, the bulbs I'd helped plant near the front gate. Sand-colored hair framed his face, slightly longer against the collar of his coat. The most striking feature, his eyes. I didn't want to look away. There was something in the slant of his gaze, deep-set, crystal-clear blue. It felt so good when he looked back at me. I cried then, deep, cleansing, hopeful tears that did not freeze on my face. A lot of our talk is lost to me. I told him, although I'm not sure if I really did, that I lived someplace other than the truth. I had an aunt that lived around the corner in the opposite direction of the house. There was an empty apartment in her building. I thought if I could hide in the hall long enough, he would be gone. I would be all right. He walked with me bundled in his coat. Without direction, he crossed the street right where I had crossed. He was going back down the hill to the place where I had begun. It could be that he followed my footprints, the blood drops in the snow. I turned only once to look away from him. Squinting, I looked ahead to where I knew I would end up. I could only hope that he would walk right by. The truck, the station wagon in my sight, I flinched when I saw the pale figures nearing the sidewalk. I've tried so many times to recall what happened after that. I can't. In the end, I compared this to an intense dream that loses parts upon wakening. Handed over, I couldn't fight it. I should have been afraid of punishment, but it never came. It was like it disappeared at one step and reappeared at another. I don't remember. I was brought into the house and put into bed. For just then, I guess, I let it all go. I never saw him leave. I don't think I was meant to. To this day, on the tip of my big toe, there remains an area that never quite came back. Years later, on the cold, snowy final day of January that the house caught fire, rats scurried in all directions, as did all the kids living there. Even still, I was sorry to watch it burn. We never did live in there again. Those days are now gone. Countless troubles remain. Loneliness, regrets, mistakes, disregard, and even more blame. So many limitations and struggles have come and passed throughout the years. So many tears shed. Time can never erase all of life's defeats, life's burdens. And then there are always so many damn influences to make you believe you're just not strong enough. Thankfully, my experience came to be my truth. Something basic I feel in the pit of my gut. What if we are all watched over and revered? What if, when we really need it, a messenger or a go-between, if you will, comes to help us? And from time to time, we are fortunate enough to know about it. Whether I summon him or not, I have seen that same face while dreaming, there to always carry me across, there to lead me to a more peaceful place, hopeful place, not always in a physical sense. Later, in what was a particularly hard time, I awoke with what I trust was his name, Michael. I call out to him, for I believe he hears my questions. And sometimes I think he answers me.
Hi, everybody. I'm Joe Cardoza. My two essays were also approved by Amanda.
I do not make them make me approve things.
The first one's called A Portrait of Cardinal Law. A portrait of Cardinal Law hung above the entrance of the chapel at Bishop Fenwick High School. By the end of 2003, Cardinal Law's presence at the core of a sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church had been well documented. Cardinal Law covered up the actions of child molesters, knowingly moving them to different parishes. I believe that to be worse than the pedophiles themselves. Cardinal Law's portrait hung above the entrance of the most sacred place in our school. So I started a petition to have the portrait removed. The members of the senior class that I spoke with were essentially unanimous. They said, "Oh, fuck off, Joe. I've worked my ass off for 3.5 years. I've got applications out to 10 different colleges. The absolute last place I want my name right now is on your bullshit anti-establishment petition." One of my only regrets in life so far is not stealing that portrait myself. The chapel was in a far-off wing of the school, and I had ample opportunities. I'm not sure why I did not steal it. I wish I had. The second essay is a eulogy for my truck. I'm trying to eulogize my truck. I keep coming up with more negative memories than positive ones. The truck got terrible gas mileage. She had dents and scratches and did not look slick. Her unquenchable desire for constant repair is the closest thing to perpetual motion that the field of science has ever witnessed. Uncle Jim had her on his lift in the beginning. I remember he shook his head sadly because I had not brought her to his garage within the limits of the lemon laws. I had bought my ticket and was forced to take the ride. Blown bulbs, snapped cables, leaky seals. She demanded constant attention and I obeyed. Uncle Dennis offered assistance and hours of research before every job I asked of him. Justin drove down from Haverhill to help on multiple occasions. Uncle Joe fashioned a running board out of the discarded ladder from an old boat. My cousin Pistol Pete at the parts store was on speed dial for automotive advice. My grandfather looked under the hood and made me promise not to tell Graham that he'd been working. My grandfather's buddy, John, got up on the ladder to check the seals while the truck was on the lift. While up on the ladder and clutching my leaky transmission, John argued with my grandfather in a way that was gentle and displayed respect. Their honest conclusion was to run away, to make her someone else's problem. I drove the 2001 Ford Escape to death. She was leaking transmission fluid when I traded her in. Maybe I should have traded her in sooner. Maybe I should have never bought her at all. She never repaid my unity and friendship. She barely held up her end of the deal. I cling to the silver lining that she was a catalyst to spend time with a large circle of family and friends. In her absence, I can honor those relationships and spend time with those people under circumstances more enjoyable than car repair. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Renee, and I am going to read a story by Maureen Cusimano, who could not be here today, but this is her story. It's called Revenge from Beyond. Dave pulls out of the garage and heads for the local watering hole. He needs to unwind after a grueling week. Charlie, pour me a double scotch, no ice. Wow, bad day, Dave? Bad day, bad week, hell, a bad month. Charlie delivers his drink. It's still early, and I'm a good listener if you needed to unload. It's just work. Can you believe my boss called me in today concerned that my sales are low this quarter? Hello, there is a recession going on. People are losing their homes and having no need for insurance. The younger kids aren't in such a rush to buy life insurance policies when they can barely get by. I hear you, Dave. This economy is affecting everyone. I had to let one of my bartenders go last week. What infuriates me about John is I was his top salesman. I guess it's like everything else. They love you when you're on top. Slip a little and you get no respect. Refill, buddy? Hell yeah. Dave said goodbye to Charlie after he finished his drink. Time to hit the road. Drive carefully, Dave. It is a cold, dark, dreary night. The fog is as thick as pea soup. It seems that the weather matches Dave's mood. Let's see if I can find some good music to lift my spirits on the 20-minute ride home. While Dave is busy fiddling around with the radio, he doesn't see the light change to red. He never saw the waitress crossing the intersection until it's too late. Oh, Jesus! The car hit her, sending her flying at least 10 feet in the air, returning her body with a loud thud on the hood of his car before she slid to the ground. Dave jumps out of his car to check on the poor woman, praying that she is not hurt bad. One look at her grotesquely twisted, mangled body and smashed-in face. Her blood pools on his hood where her body left a huge dent. His grill and bumper are damaged from the impact. Oh, God, what have I done? Dave's mind is racing frantically. I need to get help. Where is everyone? I need to call 911. Then the little voice in his head tells him, they will know you had drinks. They will know you took your eyes off the road to play with the radio. Then Dave remembered how many claims were denied due to lack of witnesses. Get back in the car. No one saw. No one knows except you and the woman lying dead in the street. It's not likely she will talk. Get out of here, Dave, before someone sees. Dave reaches down to pick up the cell phone he found next to the body. He will use her phone to call 911. They can't trace it to him. Dave jumps back into his car and heads for home. It has begun raining, and the roads were slick. Dave, drive carefully. Don't draw attention to you. You'll be fine. No one will ever know. When Dave arrives home, he parks the car in the garage and goes into the house to retrieve some cleaning supplies. The rain washed away most of the blood, but to make sure there was no trace of DNA, he needed to scrub it good. Dave is miserable all weekend, tossing and turning in bed, the image of the victim reminding him of what he did. Come Monday morning, he considered calling in sick and not going to work. Not wanting to draw attention to himself, he called a car service to drive until he decided what to do about the car. It is clean of any evidence, but there is the matter of the huge dent and broken grill. Dave passed by the newspaper stand. Headlines read, "People ask for the community's help. A waitress identified as Mary Sloan was the victim of a hit-and-run Friday night at approximately 7:45 p.m. at Miles Road Lights. A 911 call was made at approximately 8 o'clock p.m. from the victim's phone and was traced to Old Country Road. If anyone has any information, please contact local police." Dave falls asleep, exhausted. Too many nights in the past 2 weeks, he has been tortured by the face of his victim. Suddenly, he is startled awake by the soft, willowy sound of a woman's voice calling him, "Dave, Dave." He bolts up in bed. "Who's there? What do you want?" Silence follows. The room is so cold, he can see his own breath. The bedroom window is open? How did that happen? Dave climbs out of bed and shuts the window. It must have been people talking as they passed by that had woken him. He climbs back into bed and pulls the blankets around him. A feeling of dread stirs in the pit of his stomach. He is tortured the rest of the night by dreams of the woman he ran down. Dave drags himself into work the next day. His mind is preoccupied by his sleepless night. He has an eerie feeling someone is watching him. He is startled and jumps when his secretary knocks. "Mr. Parsons, are you okay?" He answers harshly, "Yes, I'm fine. What do you want?" "Mr. Olson is wondering why you didn't attend the 9 o'clock a.m. meeting this morning." "The morning meeting? What time is it?" "It's 11 a.m., sir." "11 a.m.? Why didn't you remind..." "What good are you? You can't even remind me of a meeting? Get out of my way." Dave stormed out of the room, almost knocking Carol down. "What is wrong with me? It's too many nights without sleep, that's all. Calm down. Don't let Mr. Olson see you like this." Dave hears the sound of laughter in his head. "Stop it! Stop it!" Instead of going to Mr. Olson's office, he walks straight out the front door. Dave heads for CVS to pick up some sleep aids. "Everything will be better. I just need a good night's sleep." He climbs into bed, almost immediately falling into a restless sleep. Sometime later, he is awoken by the sound of the wind blowing through his room. Then he heard it, the voice calling him. "Dave! Dave!" Dave sits up quickly. "Who's there? This isn't funny." An angry, hostile voice answers, "Funny? No, Dave, it isn't funny." He is frightened when he realizes he is looking into the angry, fiery eyes of the woman he ran down. "Go away! Leave me alone!" "Like you left me alone to die in the street, Dave?" The whole room shook with her voice. Dave tried to cover his face with the blankets. His blankets were tore off the bed. His room became a battlefield. Bureaus were overturned. Pictures flew off the wall. Look, Dave, look and see. His voice trembled. No, I don't want to see. Dave is torn from his bed and slammed against the wall. Look! An image of a small child crying in her father's arms appeared out of nowhere. Daddy, why did someone run over Mommy? I miss her, Daddy. I know you do, Pumpkin. I miss her, too. Dave watches as tears run down the man's face. Please stop. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Sorry? No, you don't even... You have not even begun to be sorry. Dave made an attempt to escape through the bedroom door. He is slammed back against the wall. Please. Oh, please. Suddenly, the room is filled with loud, booming music. Dave covers his ears. Stop! I died because you were playing with your radio. Is this the music you needed to hear? Can you hear the music, Dave? Just when he thought he couldn't take any more, the entire accident replayed before his eyes. Dave's body is shaking with sobs. I was somebody, Dave. I was a wife and a mother, and you took that away to listen to some damn music. Where's the phone, Dave? What phone? The phone you took out of my pocket to call 911 after you fled the scene. Bureau drawers are flung open, the contents spewed across the room. Dave crawled across the floor and escaped through the door. He ran as fast as he could down the stairs and out into the street. Just when Dave thought he escaped his nightmare, he heard the roar of a car engine. Dave screamed as he is hit by his own car. He laid on the ground, unable to move. Mary approached his limp-tangled body. You didn't think I was letting you go, did you, Dave? Look, I found the phone. She dialed 911 and looked at Dave. See you in hell. Months later, Dave lay in the hospital bed. Mary had shown no mercy to him. He didn't die in the accident. No, his limp body, paralyzed from the chin down, lay there day after day, living out his life as a vegetable. His vocal cords were frozen, so he was unable to tell the cops how he ran himself over or why he had possession of a cell phone that belonged to Mary Sloan. The only thing he could do was move his eyes and listen to the sounds of laughter from beyond.
I apologize for reading from this. I'm going to read a few of my own poems. I had one computer die and could not print from this. And so technology saves us and that I can manage it, but I apologize for the awkwardness.
But I went first, so I said...
But you're good at it. These are four poems that I've written in the past month or so. Outside, the icicles are meeting the snowdrifts halfway up the house. Our neighbors are snowed in. We are snowed in, too. For weeks, I wore boots with holes. I walked to the bar wearing plastic bags to keep my feet dry. A young man, a writer, heard me talking about it. He tried that once. It didn't work. I get it, he said, looking at my feet. You put the bags inside your boots. I had no words. I fell asleep with a man on an old metal cot on the back deck under the quilt my mother made for my 14th birthday. It started to rain. We let the drops fall on us. The black dye bled in the rain. It ruined the quilt. When my mother saw, it brought her to tears. I have been holding it in for years. Sometimes I remember something of it, a sound, a smell. Sometimes it is all I can do to keep myself from rushing back. I have no art left with words. I can ask questions. Would you like a cup of coffee? How have you been? It all sounds hollow. I am tired of words. There is a memory I can't hold in anymore, a mattress on top of two bait freezers in an old shack. There is something about that space, not much larger than the mattress itself, and the feeling of climbing up and the smell of rotting fish. This is something I chose, to be separate from the world in an old wooden shack, older than anybody I knew, to be quiet with the smell of engine oil and rotting fish. I feel myself getting quieter. No matter how still I get, I can't get back to those old wooden walls. In the kitchen, the men are making monologues. I walk around them to the table and the sink. I will throw a handful of words into the room. I will sweep the sand off the front stairs. I will make a quiver for my daughter's arrows. Thank you.
Today I found out that at age 68, I need braces. I tell you that because it's related to this. And I also can't see without light, so hopefully you can all see me if I sit down.
Yeah, okay. Sure.
This is called The Age of Asparagus. At 60-something, there are still things about my body that amaze me. For example, and I timed it, within 5 minutes of eating asparagus, my pee takes on that weird, icky, metallic smell somewhere in between burnt rubber and battery acid. I don't remember noticing this when I was young. Maybe there's a certain age at which a person's chemistry changes, like a breaker switch being thrown, after which everything you thought you knew about yourself alters. This might explain the unnerving development I began to notice about 15 years ago. I spotted several angry-looking red pimples on my chin. Closer inspection revealed that these eruptions were caused by horrors, whiskers. I am a pale, fair-haired, light-eyed wasp who needed a pair of tweezers only now and then to pluck the occasional errant eyebrow or remove a splinter. So I stood before the mirror, tweezers in hand, and made short work of those three chin hairs, dabbing a little makeup where they had been. A facial erratic, I told myself. Probably some hormonal imbalance. And I promptly forgot about the outbreak until it happened again the next month. Once again, I dispatched the unwanted hairs with my trusty tweezers. In the course of the year, I began having to include the plucking of chin hairs in my monthly skincare regimen. My dermatologist and I said I could always have electrolysis or laser treatment for around $200 a treatment, but there was no guaranteeing that the hairs wouldn't grow back. Not a good investment for so trivial a problem. Okay, I told myself, this is just another one of the bothersome signs of aging, like slowing down of one's metabolism or bunions or wrinkles. Don't give it a lot of weight. All went well until the day I returned home to find my husband, Dan, and the maintenance man, Gus, performing some sort of plumbing operation on our kitchen faucet. They were using my tweezers. In life, there are certain irrevocable events after which one knows things will never be the same, like the signing of the Magna Carta or the development of the hothouse tomato. Had I known a decade earlier about the demise of tweezers, I would have purchased all I could and made a fortune selling them on the black market. No! Oh, no! 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 What are you doing with my tweezers? I shouted as I snatched them from Gus's callous, greasy hands. Dan and Gus hung their heads a little, but supported each other in the instant unspoken solidarity common to all men caught using their wives' tools inappropriately. I speculate that somewhere in the late 1980s, a shrewd manufacturer figured out that the little rows of metal on the business end of the tweezers, which fit together like pinking shears, you all know what those are like, or shark's teeth, in order to grip the hair, were costly as part of the tool to manufacture. When used properly, they could last a lifetime, a definite liability for the manufacturer. So, while millions of women continued using their old tweezers to rid themselves of unwanted hair, the first tweezers with flat, unridged gripping surfaces were probably hitting the market. I didn't need to clean the grease from my tweezers to see the damage my precision instrument's teeth were gouged. Perhaps they'll still work, I thought optimistically, as I gently bathed and dried them. Selecting a nice plump eyebrow hair, I closed the tweezers on it and tried giving it a little tug. The hair slid right through the tweezers, which could no longer grip, no matter how hard I squeezed. Annoyed, but as yet undefeated, I set off for the drugstore where I bought a new pair. When I got home, I found that these were as useless as my damaged tweezers. Outraged to see that these tweezers had no teeth with which to grip, I commenced a month-long quest for what I considered real tweezers. This took me through the cosmetic sections of every drug and department store to no avail. Worse, the tweezers were now heavily packaged so that one had to open the plastic to examine them, which required buying the tweezers. Meanwhile, 6 black chin hairs had erupted along with a few stray eyebrow hairs. I'm not talking any Frida Kahlo like unibrow. Still, it was disturbing to see myself growing fuzzy without any remedy. Dan was untroubled by my dilemma. He said he wouldn't have even noticed the hairs had I not pointed them out. Husbands. I stood before the mirror wearing a jeweler's visor, duct tape in hand, studying my chin. An image came to mind of the scene from the horror movie The Fly, where the protagonist discovers the tough, insect-like hairs he is beginning to sprout as he transforms into a giant fly. I pressed the duct tape hard on my chin and gave a yank, followed by a shriek. My chin looked shiny and raw, but the whiskers were intact. I began haunting yard sales, junks, antique shops, hoping to find a pair of old tweezers. I could find none. Either other women had gotten there first and snatched them up, or all the old tweezers had been destroyed by men using them as plumbing tools. Then I remembered Bigelow's Pharmacy on 6th Avenue in the Village, one of New York City's old-style chemists. There's some New Yorkers in the audience. Bigelow was a great place to find all kinds of high-quality cosmetic supplies. I had possibly bought tweezers there many years ago. At Bigelow's, I related my problem to the sales girl, who pointed to a counter. "Tweezer man," she said, "they're really good." That's okay, I'll get that later. "They come with a guarantee, free sharpening for life." I glanced at the clerk. Her eyebrows were penciled in. The hair was totally absent. I didn't know whether or not to take this as a good sign. The tweezers' tips were pressed together behind their packaging. Their surfaces were not visible. "Can I open the package?" I asked this 20-ish clerk politely. She pushed a strand of magenta-colored hair behind her heavily pierced ear, regarding me suspiciously. I tried explaining about the little grooves common to all tweezers in the olden days. The clerk raised her penciled eyebrows as if I had just tried selling her the Brooklyn Bridge. Dan, whom I had dragged shopping with me as his penance, was sighing and yawning hugely. "No, we can't let you open them unless you buy them. You want them or what?" Back in the car with my purchase, I tore open the packaging and immediately saw the flat surfaces on the tweezers' tips. A folded paper fell out, extolling the virtues of my new tweezers, along with a guarantee stating that should they ever need sharpening, the service would be performed for free. I read it to my husband, adding, "Who cares if the tweezers are sharp, for heaven's sake?" I exploded. "I don't use them for carving steak. I need them to grip." The suspense is killing me. As we age, we must all adapt to change. Men go bald. Women grow whiskers. Maybe this is nature's way of discouraging us from having sex. These days, I spend a little more time trying to get my eternally sharp tweezers to de-hair my chin. I'm sure I even miss a few, but who cares? It's not as easy for me to see these little hairs as it used to be anyway.
Well, I'd like to thank you all for coming tonight and for my readers for so bravely reading tonight. And thank you all for your support for the Writers' Center and for the Women's Writing Group. And if you'd like to stay around for a glass of wine and a bit of cheese and crackers, we'd love to talk to you. Thank you very much. Thank you.